From the creators of the hit kids podcast, Who Smarted, and Netflix's Brainchild, comes the adventurous world of Mysteries About True Histories, affectionately known as MATH. Every episode follows Max and Molly, who have just been recruited into a secret order of problem solvers on an adventure through time packed with puzzles, hidden equations, history, and laughs, making learning cool. This podcast is perfect for ages 6 and up. I'll tell you what, guys, I've listened to a few episodes and they're super fun. I really wish that my son had had this podcast when he was younger and growing up. These episodes drop every Thursday. They're only about 15 minutes or so. The series explores themes like the stories behind math, critical thinking, code breaking, problem solving, and more. Each one is stacked with so much laughter that your kids won't even realize how much they're learning. So tune in to Mysteries About True Histories with your kids, and you can follow and listen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Welcome to the Divorce Survival Guide podcast, where we have open and honest conversations about co-parenting, separation, divorce, and the hardest question of all, should you stay or should you go? I'm Kate Anthony, your divorce survival guide, and I'm here to help you navigate some of the roughest waters you've ever swum in and answer some of your toughest questions. I've been to hell and back, and now it's my mission in life to help you get to the other side of this process with your sanity and your heart intact.
Hey everyone, welcome back. Just a quick reminder that for the month of June, I am opening up my Sanity Saver sessions to all of you guys. So if you have ever thought, oh my God, I just need like an hour of Kate's time, I just need to run this stuff by her, let me make a quick plan for how to have the conversation, how to tell my kids, how do I navigate this sort of co-parenting landscape? By the way, I spent the last few weeks becoming certified with my dear friend Christina McGee through the Mostyn Guthrie Academy as a co-parenting specialist. So I'm now certified as a co-parenting specialist. I have a lot more to say about that in the coming weeks. But for now, if you have questions about co-parenting, any of those things, anything, if you're like, oh, fuck, I just want to talk to Kate, Sanity Saver sessions are now available to you just for the month of June, though. That's it. And then they go bye-bye because I'm hunkering down and finishing my book for the rest of the summer. So today's show, we are talking today about the Facebook narcissist. I have with me an amazing guest, Lena Derhali. She's a licensed and Imago certified psychotherapist in private practice. She's the author of the Amazon true crime and criminology bestseller, My Daddy is a Hero, How Chris Watts Went from Family Man to Family Killer, and the forthcoming pop psychology book, The Facebook Narcissist, How to Identify and Protect Yourself and Your Loved Ones from Social Media Narcissism. She was also formerly a clinical instructor in the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at the George Washington School of Medicine, where she mentored medical students. So listen, she is coming back on the podcast to talk about the Chris Watts case and all of that. But today we're talking about her newer book, The Facebook Narcissist, and How to Identify and Protect Yourself and Your Loved Ones from Social Media Narcissism. This is more than just about Facebook and social media, but we do talk a lot about how Facebook and social media has really given narcissism a platform and also created narcissism where perhaps there would not otherwise have been. So there's a lot to unpack here. It's really fascinating conversation. So without further ado, here is my conversation, my first conversation with Lena Dirhali. Lena, thank you so much for coming on. And just a spoiler for everybody, this is going to be one of two episodes that we're going to do. But this first one is about your new book about social media and narcissism. And it's called The Facebook Narcissist. Yes. For obvious reasons. So yes. Let's just dive into that. So first of all, let's start with, and I think it's one of your first chapters, which is narcissism defined. Why is this such a huge topic right now? Why is everybody a narcissist?
Well, that's a great question to kick this off. I wanted to define narcissism because it is such a buzzword right now, where people sort of throw it around and it's everywhere you look, you know, every article, everything. Are you a narcissist? Are you dating a narcissist? Is your mother a narcissist? You know, it's everywhere. Mm-hmm. And just being in, you know, the general population and doing what I do, which is specializing in narcissism in my practice, I've noticed that people don't understand the scope of narcissism and how many different ways it manifests. And so how I decided to define narcissism was the way Dr. Craig Malkin, he's a Harvard psychologist, and he has a great book called Rethinking Narcissism. And he defines narcissism as what he calls triple E, which stands for entitlement, exploitation, and lack of empathy. And I think, you know, most people look at narcissism and they think about the grandiosity or the arrogance or somebody who really commands attention. And while that can be part of narcissism, in order to be a narcissist, you have to have that real disregard and callousness for others, you know, that high entitlement, exploiting others as a pattern, mm-hmm. and low empathy. And just one other thing, I think it's important to note that I also like to define narcissism on a spectrum, which is also how Dr. Malkin does as well. And so obviously, if you're looking at it as a scale from about 1 to 10, and you're looking at 8 to 10 as being really high, I think that's where you get the really dangerous, really cruel, abusive people. But then you can interact with people in your regular life who have some of these traits, but may not qualify as a full-blown narcissist. But I still think it's important to know mm-hmm. how to define that and how mm-hmm. to protect yourself from that, or how to interact with those people. So that's my platform speech for you. But if you want, we can also go into how I define the subtypes of narcissism in my book.
Yes, I do want to get into that for sure. I want to actually first back up a little bit, and I want to ask you to expand on the idea of these people being exploitive. What does that mean?
They take advantage of other people. So what that might look like is, you know, you have somebody who owns a company, and they're constantly making their employees work overtime without paying them for that overtime. I worked for a company once where I was entitled to a lunch break, and they wouldn't even give me a real lunch break or mm-hmm. even give me bathroom breaks. I actually had to ask for permission to go to the bathroom. And I was 25 years old at the time. This is New York City entertainment industry. Oh, but you sure, know, you're looking at things like that, and it's, right. you know, it's a real disregard for other people. And so it's using people and taking advantage of them and knowing that you're doing it too. And again, I like to see that, you know, I like to say with narcissists, that's a pattern. So, you know, if yes. someone does something like that once, okay, that's not a great sign, but you know, you really want to look for that pattern of someone who's doing that pretty uh-huh. regularly.
Right. And in relationships, this could manifest as what? Like, how does that look in a relationship? Like, how could people identify that in their relationship?
Yeah, you could look at, you know, forms of coercive control and, you know, financial control. It may be a partner, you know, controlling the finances or saying, you know, I'm going to give you an allowance. You can get $10 a week, you know, or something like that. Right. And, you know, just again, taking advantage of that person in some way, and treating them as they're undervalued, you know, and not an equal.
Right. Yes. And there's something I think in there that is to do with the power and control wheel, that it is about power and control over just about anything else.
Oh yeah. And narcissistic people need to be in control and need power, and they thrive off of that. Yeah. And they look for ways all the time where they can assert control or have power over others. It's a real high for them.
Then there are these subtypes. So let's get into some of those.
So in my book, I define four of them, and they're not my personal definitions, but they're, you know, from other researchers and psychologists. And the first is malignant narcissism, which I think your listeners will probably be most familiar with. And that is sort of the dark triad, which, you know, it's like a mix of almost like psychopathy, narcissism, and Machiavellianism. Again, I think you're kind of, when you're looking at that, you may see that in a lot of these world leaders, you know, who are really, again, they love that power and they're
shall
sadistic.
We say Putin currently.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. For example, that would be the prime example. Yes, that would be the prime example right now of what that would look like. And of course, you know, you don't have to have that much notoriety to have that, but they're really dangerous people.
Yeah.
They're very cruel people. They inflict a lot of harm on people. And I think that's really that element of sadism, you know, enjoying inflicting harm on people really can come into the malignant narcissism. So that's almost taking it like narcissism 2.0, extreme.
Right. And that's really rare, right? Like
yes.
We have to like, and it's because I think it's really important to say that like, not like, even if you're in an abusive relationship with a narcissist, they're not necessarily this Machiavellian, like this is like true evil.
Yes.
That we're talking about.
Yeah. Yeah. They have, I would say, you know, close to zero empathy, mm-hmm. no concern. Like those are people who probably murder, but some people would also argue that somebody like Bernie Madoff was a malignant narcissist. And I talk about exploitation, right?
So yes, right.
It wasn't that he, right. Mm-hmm. It's not that he physically hurt people or murdered people, but the callousness that he displayed and the exploitation and the entitlement and low empathy of all the people that he took money from and played that role as this charming, you know, he was the master manipulator for many, many years. So you don't have to be physically aggressive. There can be other ways that people would say the malignant narcissism would manifest. And you're mm-hmm. right. I think mm-hmm. that thankfully that's quite rare. And then I moved to covert or vulnerable narcissism. People use that interchangeably, where this is not the grandiose narcissist. So narcissistic personality disorder, NPD, in the DSM, which is this, I call it the psychology Bible. It's got all, you know, the diagnoses listed. That one is really about grandiosity and arrogance and pompousness and commanding the attention from other people. It's big, it's boisterous energy. Now, covert and vulnerable narcissism, you really want to get back to that triple E, because it's not about how they're outward in the world. It's how they think about themselves and how they are behind closed doors. And so a covert or vulnerable narcissist may harbor secret fantasies about being recognized as important or powerful, but they may be your nice next door neighbor mowing the lawn who's not outwardly seeking any type of power, control, notoriety. And covert and vulnerable narcissists, you really find them in a lot of romantic relationships, because on the outside to the outside world, they seem actually like really nice people. You know, like I said, it could be your nice neighbor. You can't identify them as well, but behind closed doors, they're doing that whole Jekyll and Hyde thing, switching back and forth between the cruel, abusive, gaslighting personality. And then the next day they're pretending nothing happened and they're telling you how great you are. And so that type of thing that happens behind closed doors, a lot of people would be shocked if they heard their friend confide in them. Hey, you know, I think that my husband or my partner or whatever is mm-hmm, mm-hmm. is narcissistic, but oh no, but he's so humble, you know. But it's really about the triple E.
It's really interesting the way that you also call it vulnerable. I hadn't actually heard that before. I've heard covert all the time, right? But their use of vulnerability to manipulate and control. It is,
that's part of it.
Mm-hmm. And it's right, it's so specific. In my
yes.
experience, like it's this very specific, but I'm just trying to tell you how I feel.
They could use insidious. That and weaponize that, but they're yep. also super thin skinned and fragile. And I think
yes.
that's where the vulnerable comes from, is when we're looking at narcissistic rage, which is when a narcissistic person perceives something as an insult to them, they will rage at you. And rage doesn't always, again, have to be this explosive anger. Rage can be like, I'm going to shut down and give you the complete silent treatment for weeks and look at you with contempt and make you feel like the worst person in the world. So narcissistic rage can look like that as well. And so a covert narcissist, really, I think they take everything, like perceived criticism, walking on eggshells, their ego is so fragile, you know, and so they get angry quickly. And so I think that's part of the vulnerable profile.
Yeah. You're describing my ex to a T.
Yeah. And grandiose narcissists also have narcissistic rage. But yeah, the thing about the covert narcissist, they're really kind of snippy and you're walking on eggshells around them. And their ego seems really fragile and you never know how you're going to offend them. That could be a clue, one of many clues that could point to that being the case as them as a vulnerable covert.
You guys, warmer, sunnier days are calling and you're going to want to fuel up for them with Factor's no prep, no mess meals. Factor's fresh, never frozen meals are dietitian approved and they're ready to eat in just 2 minutes. So no matter how busy you are, you're always going to have time to enjoy nutritious, great tasting meals. And I know that's really important to you guys right now. You're going through a hard time. You're in emotional upheaval, maybe some chaos, really good, healthy, nutritious meals in 2 minutes. And I'm telling you, they're so good. You've got 35 different meals and more than 60 add-ons to choose from every week. And you'll always have new flavors to explore. Treat yourself to restaurant quality meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, blackened salmon. Ugh, so good, you guys. So head to factormeals.com/DSG50 and use code DSG50 to get 50% off your first box, plus 20% off your next month. So the code is DSG50 at factormeals.com/DSG50 to get 50% off your first box, plus 20% off your next month while your subscription is active. Hey, are any of you guys going through menopause or perimenopause? Ugh, you know how you can't find any comfort in your body? Or even if you're done, if you're on the other side like I am, but you still kind of feel like a wet sock on a busy highway? You've got to try Hormone Harmony. So Hormone Harmony contains science-backed herbal extracts called adaptogens. So here's the beauty about adaptogens. They help the body, wait for it, adapt to any stressors, like chaotic hormone changes that happen naturally throughout a woman's life. So it's not just for menopause. Any woman with symptoms of any hormonal imbalance can take it, but it's perfect for those horrible menopausal and perimenopausal symptoms that put a woman's life on hold. Hot flashes and night sweats, racing thoughts and low moods, poor sleep and feeling tired all the time, occasional bloating and gas. Yeah, Hormone Harmony can help with all of those things. And the biggest benefit, feeling like myself again. That's what women mention over and over and over again in their reviews. And there are over 17,000 reviews for Hormone Harmony. So for a limited time, you can get 15% off on your entire first order at happymammoth.com. Just use the code DSG at checkout. That's happymammoth.com and use the code DSG for 15% off today.
Are there, okay, so are there any other subtypes?
There's two more.
Okay.
And then I go, communal narcissism to me is the most fascinating. And I learned about communal narcissism when I was researching for my book that we'll talk about next time about Chris Watts, the man who killed his family in Colorado. And the reason I got so interested and I was blown away when I heard about communal narcissism is because the profile of the communal narcissist is the opposite of your grandiose narcissist. And communal meaning they seek narcissistic supply, which is attention and praise. Again, something that all narcissists need and kind of live by, you know, that's how they fuel themselves. They need that attention, praise. Communal narcissists don't use selfish means to get attention and praise. In fact, they figured out, oh, if I'm this good, charitable person, people will praise me for how great I am and how kind I am. So you might see these people as pastors at churches or rabbis or, you know, religious leaders. You may see them as the PTA presidents. Mm-hmm. You may see them even as, you know, somebody who's just, again, on social media, since my book is about how these things manifest on social media. Right, exactly. Yeah. It's like, hey, I just made these great charitable donations. And then people are, you know, responding to them like, oh, you're such a kind person. And so their whole persona is just about being trustworthy and likable and a do-gooder. I call it the do-gooder narcissist. Mm-hmm. But they could also be, have those three entities, you know, the low empathy, exploitation, entitlement, and they like the attention. And it's all about them. It's not actually about enjoying doing good for others. They're doing it solely for the purpose of the attention that it's going to bring them, the positive attention. And, you know, I had a woman write to me once, and after she read my Chris Watts book, and she said, you know, I think my ex was a communal narcissist. He was a missionary and he did all these great things, but behind the scenes, he was like a child abuser and molesting children. You know, like there can be this really, really dark side to somebody who seemingly is doing all this good in the world, which I think is so important for us to all have this knowledge. Just because somebody does good does not mean they are good.
Oh, so good. This is sort of like the cult leader profile too, right?
Like Keith Raniere from the NXIVM cult.
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. And also, you know, Jim Jones, right? Because he started out actually doing some really great work in San Francisco in his early days, right?
Right.
And he was like the first like really inclusive church, like all of this stuff. And then it just fucking spiraled from there. Yeah. Yep. Okay. So, all right. So let's
and one more.
Oh, one more. Sorry. Yeah. Yes. Sorry.
And this was one too, that was new to this book. And this is something I recently discovered as well. It's called Collective Narcissism. And I'm really excited about this one because I was actually able to interview the woman who developed the Collective Narcissism Inventory Scale, which is sort of the checklist of what qualifies someone to be these sort of subtypes of narcissism. And she's in my book and she's done a bulk of the research. And collective narcissism is what they're tying to sort of populism and authoritarianism and racism and nationalism. It's narcissism around your group instead of yourself as an individual. So it's the belief that my group is superior and entitled to special treatment. And my narcissistic rage is on behalf of the group. And it can be any group. It could be your book club, for example, which is probably not, you know, but right. Something as small
best
as
best book
that.
Club in the world.
Right. Right.
But and that's fine. Mm-hmm. Right. But then we're talking about, but when we're talking about, as you said, like authoritarianism, racism, populism, nationalism, all of this, like we are in trouble and we're there.
Yeah. And if you think about it, it makes sense because, again, we're looking at entitlement, exploitation, lack of empathy. And again, in my book, there's a lot of great research out there tying racism to narcissism, which makes sense because if you believe you're better than someone else by your skin color, you know, then yes, that's low empathy. That's entitlement. You will exploit other people who are not like you. And so I think at the end of the day, all the worst things that we see in the world are connected to these various subtypes of narcissism, but we don't really have a clue that it manifests in all these different ways. So part of, you know, what I like to do is I really like to educate people. Like, there's so many ways this can manifest. And if you feel like you're gaslighting yourself, like the communal narcissist, oh, but this person's so nice. I like people to know, well, maybe they are, but you're not crazy. Like they can still be a narcissist. So.
Right. Yeah. Yes. And I, you know, I wonder, I have a theory about this and I don't know if this has any scientific research backing at all. And I would love for somebody else to do the research. It's because I don't have time. In my mind, I feel like we have a bigger problem in this about all of this in the US than almost anywhere else. I know that we have the highest rates of serial killers per capita than any nation in the world. It feels to me like this is on that same scale. Like there's something in our culture, in our cultural drinking water that is creating this. Is that, do you think that that's supported?
I agree, especially because I think America, especially as we've seen in the pandemic, is very much about individualism. And that there's a lot of lack of empathy when, you know, individualism, like we're not responsible for each other instead of looking at us as being in a community. And I think those values of not taking care of other people and not taking care of our people are much more prominent in America than other countries. You know, the fact that people are dying because they can't afford insulin is insane.
It's insanity. It's insanity.
People should be able, everybody should be able to have access to medicine. You know, there shouldn't be such vast income inequality, which I guess could be a whole other podcast. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think again, because America is so focused on individualism and, you know, I don't have to take care of you. You're responsible for yourself. I think that breeds a culture of narcissism.
Absolutely. I so completely agree. And yeah, we did see it so horrifically during the pandemic. It was so, and you know, even though, you know, we had just lived through the Trump years and like we were seeing a lot of this anyway, once the pandemic hit and it sort of came to a head in a way that was so shocking to me. Like I still like I deal with this every day. Like this is my work as well. And you know, I'm in the trenches with this all the time and I'm still always surprised. And I'm always like, what? people don't feel like we should all be vaccinated because it helps everybody. Like what? And it like never ceases to amaze me.
I think actually even before vaccines, there was some research that came out that was correlating psychopaths with anti-maskers. Not saying every anti-masker is a psychopath, but there was a strong correlation between people who were very defiant about wearing a mask in a grocery store for 15 minutes and making such a big deal about it as having some traits of psychopathy, which again is that this lack of care.
No empathy. There is no empathy.
I remember an incident actually, because where I live in DC, it's, you know, we've had stronger mask mandates than a lot of other places. And I was actually in Maryland in a town over. And this was during the mandates and I was at Whole Foods and there was a woman, you know, talking back to an employee and yelling at him. He asked her to put her mask on and she decided to fight back, you know, and really give him a hard time.
At Whole Foods.
And I stepped in at that point and I was, you know, I said, ma'am, respectfully, you know, while you may not believe the mask rule is legit, I said, you're in somebody else's place of business and this is their rule. So while you're in their place of business, you respect their rule. And it's sort of, that's entitlement. Okay. And that's how I explain it to my kids.
Yep.
When you go to somebody else's house and they ask you to take off your shoes, you may not think that rule is a good rule, but you're a guest in someone's house. You're not entitled to say, I'm not going to wear my shoes in your house. And so I think that's another way I look at entitlement.
Yeah.
And again, entitlement is a big part of the narcissistic profile.
Okay. So let's talk about social media and let's talk about how this, it manifests, it shows up and, or is exacerbated by, is created by, which came first, the chicken or the egg? Yeah,
exactly. And a lot of social scientists are still trying to figure this out. I think the general consensus, and there's really mixed evidence right now, but the general consensus is narcissists are drawn to social media. It's kind of a playground for them. Mm-hmm. And in the book, I explore very different ways and what this looks like, whether it's catfishing women on apps or Facebook, you know, or things like that. Or getting attention and validation. It's a great place for narcissistic supply, or using something like Facebook or Instagram as a tool to make somebody else feel bad by, you know, here's a party we were at. We know this person's going to see it. You know, there's different ways that they use social media for their agenda. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I thought that was really important to show in the book is that, you know, social media is a place where you're going to encounter narcissism. How do you protect yourself from that? But I also wanted to look at, does social media cause more narcissism or exacerbate it or bring it out?
Yeah.
And there was one interesting study where they looked at MySpace. Remember MySpace back in the day, this pre-Facebook. And it's, you know, for those who don't know, it's just a platform. It was kind of the pre-Facebook where you had a profile about yourself and people could look at it. there was one study shown that the more time people spent on MySpace, it was like 15 minutes or extra or something, the higher they scored on the inventory of narcissism. So I thought that was really interesting that there was actually a study saying that people actually did score higher narcissism after spending more time on the platform. So that was one thing. But there was also a woman I read about in my influencer chapter who talked about how becoming an influencer was mining the depths of her narcissism. I used that exactly, her quote. And I just thought that was really profound as someone who was becoming an influencer and noticing herself becoming more vapid, vain, narcissistic, and not liking that. And so then she chose to remove herself from that. And so that's the piece that I actually find really interesting is like, what is this mining and curating, you know, our vanity and putting out this image to the world, but the people who have to do it constantly, right? Like, what is that? They become more self-involved because it's all about them and their job is all about them. So inevitably, you know, I talk to behavioral psychologists about that. Yes, like the more you do something, the more you believe it. Behavior is important. The more repeated behavior happens, you know, the more you become that in a lot of ways. And so I think we don't have so much evidence yet to say that social media like definitively can cause narcissism, but I think there's some compelling stuff out there.
So it's interesting, right? Because this woman who said, the influencer who said that it was mining the depths of her narcissism, the fact that she was able to be objective about that and then make a change about it indicates that she's not actually a narcissist.
No,
right?
No, not at all.
Right. So, and I had a similar experience that I'll share briefly, which is that I, you know, throughout the 2016 election and the sort of the beginnings of the Black Lives Matter movement in 2015, and like when things were like really getting to a head and then into the election and stuff like that, I was writing a lot on social media about all of this stuff. And then throughout the Trump years, and I was very vocal and I became someone that people listened to, right? My voice became, so, you know, somewhat, I don't know, you know, influencing, I guess, in that sphere. And I got to a point, and it was, I think it was after the 2020 election, where we were all just so tired. I think it was just like, okay, now I can breathe for a minute. I sort of stopped posting the way that I had been. And with this sort of like distance, I would go in and be like, I should probably say something about, and then I was like, why? Like, who cares? Why is my voice, like, why does my voice matter? Why do I think my voice matters? Like, who fucking cares? Right? Who cares what I have to say? There are a million people who have like degrees in this. Like, if you want to know what's going on politically, like read Heather Cox Richardson. Like, what do I, like, why do I matter? And I just sort of got to that point where I was like, I am, and it was an about face. Like it was a very sudden about face where I was like, I'm done. I'm so done with this. Like, I don't care. Yeah. And then I was even going to write something about like, hey guys, I'm stepping away because I noticed this thing, and like write a whole missive about that. And I was like, but again, who cares? Like, how ironic would it be to write about that? Like, forget it. And I just stepped away. And I, you know, and what was interesting is that not a single person who followed me, the like 4,000 friends that I have, whatever, nobody messaged me to be like, hey, haven't seen you post for a while. Are you okay? Like, because literally, nobody fucking cared.
Well, I love that you said that, because it's such a great example though of like, again, but first I want to say you do matter and your voice does matter. And I think, you know, we have to find that balance of being like, yeah, I matter. My voice matters. However, you kept yourself in check by being like, I'm not the most important voice in the world. And like, I don't have to comment on everything. And
right. And my voice matters on like, my business page and my Instagram page and my TikTok videos. Like I completely own and honor where my voice matters in that. But it's like commentary, like whatever.
It was like there was a joke going around when, you know, a horrible situation when the Afghanis were fleeing that whole thing. And, you know, it's also, we're still in the pandemic at that, you know, and someone was like, I love how everybody online are now geopoliticists and like epidemiologists, you know, because it's like people who don't have authority in foreign policy or disease or control or you know, virology or whatever. It's like everybody is the expert.
And exactly.
Or also the idea of social media, I think, seduces everybody to think that like they can have a voice in everything. Like you have to comment on everything. So maybe, right. you know, for example, Johnny Depp, Amber Heard, of course, like you, Kate, could comment on that.
This is a
trial where they're actually talking about personality disorders. Coming into it. But I mean, not everybody has to make a comment about Will Smith, Chris Rock, and Amber Heard and Johnny Depp and Afghanistan and Ukraine, you know, all of these things happening. Sometimes you have to step back and be like, hey, I don't have to comment.
We all know that feeling. You open your closet. It's full, but you have literally nothing to wear. Story of my life, you guys. Enter Armoire. Armoire allows you to rent high-quality designer clothing for every occasion. Whether you're planning your outfit for a date, or packing for a conference for work, or you need a gown for a black tie event, you will always be the best-dressed person in the room without ever having to brave a fitting room with fluorescent lights. Armoire makes getting dressed easy. With a clothing rental membership from Armoire, build the perfect wardrobe with brands that are high quality, unique, and recommended just for you. All you have to do is take a 5-minute style quiz and select items from your dynamic personalized closet, and then the styles show up at your door in as little as 2 days. And then when you're ready for new clothes, you just swap them out for more new to you styles. But here's the deal. Armoire is also women founded and women led. They even spotlight women owned designers on their website. So I know that I'm wearing brands that are aligned with my values. And if you're listening to my podcast, probably yours. I love that I can support a business that's built by women like me. And if you're ready to have your dream closet delivered to your door, you've got to try Armoire. I promise you will never be without the perfect outfit for any occasion ever again. How about that? So right now, my listeners can give Armoire a try and get up to 50% off their first month. That's up to $125 off. Just visit armoire.style/DSG. So that's Armoire, Armoire. .style/DSG to get up to 50% off your first month and never worry about what to wear again. Try Armoire today.
I'm Margaret.
And I'm Amy.
And together we host the podcast, What Fresh Hell? Laughing in the Face of Motherhood.
Margaret, I would say you're sort of a where are my keys kind of mom.
Correct. Sometimes a where are my kids kind of mom. While you're Amy, more of a we were supposed to leave 35 seconds ago, mom.
I mean, touche. In each episode of What Fresh Hell, we come at a topic from our usually completely opposite perspectives. I bring the research.
And I bring kind of the gimlet eye. Like, is that research really going to work, people?
And almost 10 million downloads later, we're still laughing.
We also talk to experts in the parenting field, plus parents with stories we can all learn from.
We make each other laugh, we challenge each other's assumptions, and we have what we think is the best parenting community on the internet.
Check out What Fresh Hell, Laughing in the Face of Motherhood, wherever you listen to podcasts.
So let's talk about this influencer situation. So like, that's an example of an influencer who like me, like took a step back and was like, this doesn't feel right. Yeah. What about the rest of them? The ones who are still doing it, the ones who, you know, what is happening? Yeah. And this feels like a feeding, like a self-feeding kind of thing, right?
Yeah, I have a lot of concerns about influencer culture. And I'm not saying that every influencer or every influencer with a big platform is a narcissist. I'm not saying that at all. But I take issue with the fact that, you know, what it's doing to also those observers and the people who get so deep into it, like the woman I talked about who said it was mining the depths of my narcissism. And she became obsessed with herself and her image and what she was putting out there. And then, you know, I also talk in the book about the addictive nature of social media. So it's not even blaming people for this. It's like you combine this with this addictive nature and an inherent need for all of us to have validation. As a therapist, my work, especially with couples, it's all about validation. It's okay to want and need validation. We're human beings. We need to be appreciated, validated. You know, we need to feel unconditionally loved by the people in our lives. And so I don't want people to think like, oh, validation is bad. But what social media does is it makes you addicted to it and the likes. And then the more you get, the more you want. And it almost becomes like a drug. And so with this influencer culture, I was also concerned about people who were observing it and seeing, because let's face it, a lot of these influencers who are really successful are really skinny. They filter all their images. They have picture perfect lives. Some of these mommy bloggers, they talk about how they're trying to normalize things, but at the same time, they have a full face of makeup and the, you know, color coordinated outfits. And, you know, even if you're conscious of this stuff, it still even subconsciously can make you feel bad. Mm-hmm. And I actually had a conversation with a good friend a couple of weeks ago, and she's really not a social media person, but she's on LinkedIn. And she's very successful in her career. And she's like, you know, I'm a self-aware person. I like myself, but I go on LinkedIn and I leave feeling bad about myself, because even though she's aware of this stuff, it still makes her feel bad when it's like, so-and-so just got this award, you know, and so-and-so is doing all this. And so I'm also interested in how looking at people who, you know, seemingly have these great lives and perfection, whether it's career or family or beauty or looking good in a bikini, like what that's doing to all of us who are watching it, and how the lengths we'll go to measure up, which I also tie into celebrity culture, is now that we see all these celebrities, like our values have become skewed. It's like our values are like, oh, if, you know, you're nothing unless you're on a yacht or you're at the Met Gala or you know, you have Botox or fillers. And a lot of the experts I talked to for this book have said there's a lot of research showing how our values are changing as generations go on, and that girls used to write in their diaries. A great woman I interviewed for my book, her name's Anne Mann. She wrote a book called The Life of I, which is about narcissism. And she told me that, you know, back in the day, young girls would write in their diaries about improving themselves as a person and character and things like that. And now as you look at girls' diaries throughout the years, they're sort of like, oh, I wish my lips were bigger or my boobs were bigger or something like that. And just, we have to look at social media as one of the catalysts of that, if not one of the biggest catalysts.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. 100%.
And I think people who are doing this work, like being so public online, especially through their image, I think they have a responsibility over that. And what I really liked is Norway actually in July of 2021 passed a law where they said influencers now have to label their photos when they've altered it in any way. So, you know, in the US, influencers now have to label when they're doing an ad. So you'll see hashtag ad or paid partnership with at the top. In Norway, if you filter or you Photoshop, you have to label that. And they said the reason they did that was because the mental health crisis in girls, because of what they're seeing on social media, has gotten so extreme that this is one of the ways they're doing to combat all of that. So I think that speaks volumes.
I mean, it's like, God, it feels like such a Band-Aid, right? Like, okay, great. Now we label it, but we're not going to stop it. I mean, not that we can, you know, have like government interference to mandate these things, but really, right? Like Mark Zuckerberg isn't going to do a goddamn thing about this because,
well, yeah. And that's a whole other issue, which like, I also talk about these entities like Facebook, big tech, like, that's a narcissistic entity. Everything about social media is exploitive, entitled, low empathy for the people who use it. So again, there's these different levels of, yeah, I think as individuals, we have to be responsible about what we put out there and who's looking at it. But also, we also got to blame the big guys at the top who know this is happening and continue to exploit it for money. So, you know, they would call that surveillance capitalism, is again, using our information and all that and mining this data from us to exploit us for profit. And then there's also just exploiting us in general, you know, by taking our insecurities and knowing that insecurities also drive engagement. And another study I read was about Twitter, where they were saying most engagement on Twitter is driven through vitriolic tweets.
Mm.
And Twitter knows that. And so the more vitriolic or divisive a tweet is, the more retweets it gets. And so if you think about that, it's like people, narcissistic people who want attention, once they figure this out, I'm sure you can think of many examples of people who are divisive and vitriolic on purpose on, you know, these platforms.
Yeah.
And also the Agnieszka Golek-Zavala, who is the collective narcissism researcher, she also says leaders on social media can use this with collectively narcissistic people to mobilize them, you know,
like a certain,
like rev them up,
like a certain someone,
yes,
like a certain someone to,
yes, like our group is not being sufficiently recognized, you know?
Yes. Right. Our group actually won the election.
Exactly. And then stirring people up stirring up that collective narcissism and mobilizing them, and making their narcissistic rage even bigger. And so again, like there's so many ways this stuff is so problematic.
It's so, so, okay. I want to, before we get to like, what do we do? Lena, I want to talk about two things. You have a chapter in the book about relationships and then also on kids. So let's talk about both of these things. Mm-hmm. How is this narcissistic, it's one thing to talk about how social media is impacting relationships, but how specifically is this narcissism thread in social media impacting our relationships?
Yes. So that chapter, I break it up into three parts: friendship, family, and romantic relationships. Mm-hmm. And friendship, I was intrigued by all the friendships that I saw dissolved because of social media, and including myself. I used to have, 700 friends on Facebook, which I talk about in the book, my own personal journey. And realizing my own stuff that it was bringing out in me that I didn't like, hey, why am I posting this to all these 700 people? They're not really my friends. They don't care about seeing my baby, for example. So I had my own moments about that. But I also realized that I liked a lot of people better when I wasn't friends with them on social media, and it was skewing my perception of them. And in some cases, it was really narcissistic behavior that I was seeing from them. But I was also interested to see sort of as a self-reflection for people, because at the end of every chapter, there's food for thought, just so you're sort of thinking about your own behavior on social media. Again, not saying you're a narcissist, because I think, as Kate, you said earlier on, if you're asking yourself if you're a narcissist, you're not. If you're an extreme narcissist, you don't think you are.
Right.
So, what I looked at, the different things that kind of annoyed people about their friends on Facebook that could be correlated with narcissism, like obsessive selfie posting, or, all constantly bragging about the vacations, which could have elements of narcissism, or, something they call vague booking, which is like posting something really vague in order to get attention. But I also wanted to be careful to say, like, just because these people might do these things and it might annoy people, it's not necessarily narcissism. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of trauma related stuff that brings this out in people. So again, people seeking attention on social media doesn't always mean they're a narcissist, but they could have, developmental trauma, and they're really starved for that. So I also really want to be clear about how we need to be compassionate towards people. So, when we might get annoyed by something like that, which I, admittedly tended to do, that it also may be coming from a place of deep pain instead of narcissism. So I also really wanted to define what is and what isn't. So that's friendship.
Yes. Okay. Yes. That makes sense.
And then family, it's really interesting when you put narcissistic family members on social media. People are having to block their own parents sometimes, or a sister. And I have a lot of interviews and case studies in this book too. But, there's a lot of stories about a narcissistic mother who may use social media to harass their child, which is like, oh, you look fat in that photo. Like, I heard stories of a mother taking a photo of her kid and texting it, you look fat in this photo, you shouldn't post it. Or getting hurt and crying, be like, oh, you don't post enough about me on Mother's Day. Narcissistic behaviors like that. So how to recognize and protect yourself and put up boundaries from family members who use social media, again, as a way to kind of torment you or to make you feel bad about yourself. Mm-hmm. So that was one, another. And then relationships, I looked at catfishing, infidelity, and all of that stuff. Infidelity, by the way, has very high correlations with narcissism and narcissistic personalities. And that has been ramped up with social media and giving people more of a playground to, again, use their love bombing to find partners on social media.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes, absolutely. And then is texting really cheating, or like, you know, I'm just messaging this person, right? Mm-hmm. And it's not, nothing happened. I didn't do anything, right?
Emotional infidelity.
And it is the entire, I think that is the entitlement piece too, mm-hmm. right? That's a huge piece of that.
Huge.
There's a book. Have you seen this or read this? This book called Cheating Land.
No, I haven't even heard of it.
The Secret Confessions of Men Who Stray by Anonymous.
Anonymous.
He didn't even want to put his name on the book. And I got, I will confess, 35 pages in before I had to stop reading this book because the rage that it induced in me was so extreme. It's because a man wants a wife who helps build a happy, close-knit family, who helps him to be seen as someone who has a loving unit that is a valued part of their community, thus making him look good, because that's our fucking job, right? Uh-huh. She helps him for, this is what men want. This is the entitlement, right? She helps him forge his legacy. When men cheat, they want to have another woman in their lives who pumps up their ego, helping them feel attractive, sexy, and powerful. They want to be both the proud patriarch with an unforgettable lady at their side and the sexual animal they felt like when they were younger. These are two distinct areas that cannot be inhabited easily by the same woman.
Oh my God.
Now that's like, you know, 6 pages before I had to put this down.
Wow. Misogyny in a book, like just all of it.
Just all of it. Well, and this is why, you know, this actually came out of conversations with all these dudes.
Oh,
with
yeah.
Anyone who would admit to cheating, it was because of the, it was this narcissistic, like rush of excitement and like, yeah. And all of them were like, I love my wife. Oh, I love my wife. I would never want to hurt her. Like I can't live without her.
But I'm entitled to cheat on her. But I don't have to care about her feelings as long as I get what I want. And that's narcissism.
Yeah. Right. Exactly. So, and I think that social media helps with this, right?
It's just
it's like, here's a platform on which you can.
Yeah. And there's research on this too, that's what a major way people are finding ways to cheat. As access, right?
Yes,
and,
absolutely.
And right. Again, being able to love bomb and use, you know, and so that's again in the book. I look for like, hey, this is how somebody might be love bombing you on social media. Here's these red flags. And a lot of your listeners are probably very seasoned and love bombing and knowing what it is. But again, there's a lot of people out there who don't know when they're being love bombed.
Yeah. Well, so how does that show? How does love bombing show up on social media?
You know, again, you're getting a message from someone you don't know, which is, I think, always a little sus, as my kids would say, suspect, suspicious. And, you know, again, it's really overly complimentary and flattering. And, you know, love bombing in general is like they don't really know you well, but they know they want to spend the rest of their lives with you, or you're so gorgeous. Or just if there's just an extreme amount of flattery, it might feel good to be flattered, but I think it's red flag. Yep. Number one. And then if you're talking with somebody online for a while, for example, you might start to get these little cute clues that, you know, there might be some possessiveness, like they don't really want you to hang out with your friends, or they want to spend all their time with you, or they may get a little bit annoyed if you're like, hey, I have to go, I have to make a call with someone else. And, oh, you don't want to stay on with me, you know? So you may be able to get like these little clues. You know,
like anyone sliding into your DMs that you don't know, or that like is a friend of a friend, like you'll see this really often, right? You're like commenting on somebody's post and like a friend is also commenting, and then they slide into your DMs, right? And then they want to know more about you. You seemed really interesting, right?
Yes.
And then it like escalates.
Yes. And not saying that all those people are narcissists, but just keep your guard up, you know, just get to know people. You know, also how much are people putting out there? I have a case study in my book, which I've heard this actual type of story from many different women about meeting somebody and having a real relationship with them and then finding out they have a family. But like some people meet these guys on Facebook and they don't have a lot on their profile. And so in the story that I have, the woman found out her man had another family and another life because she tagged him on Facebook in a picture when they were out on a weekend getaway together, and he flipped out and was like, don't ever tag me again. Like he didn't, you know. And so it's like these different ways that you can sort of also figure out, you know, now with the internet, you can also be a sleuth yourself and Google people and find out ways to kind of make sure that they are who they say they are.
And also, like, dude, there are tag settings. Like you can can disable that yourself, but also like if it's disabled, why?
Yeah. Right. Exactly.
Oh my goodness. Okay. So let's talk about our kids. How is this changing our children? I will say, as having a teenager, I have seen this. I mean, it's terrifying what it's doing to them.
It is. And we have a lot of evidence again that social media at least is a part or plays a role in the growing mental health crisis we're seeing with teens, which is making news everywhere. Teens are more depressed, anxious, suicidal than they ever were before. And this started actually before the pandemic. So we can't blame it all on the isolation of the pandemic, but the pandemic definitely made it worse.
No, but what, you know, I will say that like during the pandemic, social media was their only social connection. Right. And so that actually, you know, at a time when maybe we would have been like, we're cutting this off. It was like, fuck.
A lifeline. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And again, I try to say in the book, like, I don't want to say, first of all, it's unrealistic for me to be like, everybody deactivate your social media accounts. That's not going to happen.
No.
And so again, the book is more like being mindful about it and just being aware. And so it's not like necessarily telling you to get off of it altogether. So I think there are good parts of it as well. So I don't want to say it's all bad. Mm-hmm. I do think the bad outweighs the good in a lot of situations, but I believe, you know, what you said is like, yeah, there's some good parts about it. And there are some things that you'll see, like some TikTokers are destigmatizing mental health, for example. So it's sort of about how you use it and the content you consume and being very boundaried about it. Right. Mm-hmm. And not making it. But again, with teens, what we worry about too is the addictive component of it. And they're also, and you know, preteens, for example, too, I think you have to be 13 to use social media, but their brains are still developing. They're figuring out their identity, and then they're being bombarded with all of this, but they're also being bombarded with constant information, which is bad for adult brains, but really bad for teen brains. They can't process all of it. Mm-hmm. So it's just coming at them, boom, boom, boom. And, you know, they have to process it. But we're really seeing, again, a huge crisis with the body dysmorphia and then stuff like kids on Instagram seeing, you know, themselves being left out of a party. It's really horrible. And I also have a chapter on cyberbullies, which to me, the cyberbully part and cyber stalkers was one of the scariest chapters to write, because the cyberbullies actually really have not only correlations with narcissism, but sadism. So like really kind of people with sadistic tendencies, you know, like to go online and torture people. And we have the most heartbreaking stories of young people, you know, people as young as 12 are committing suicide. And a lot of it is because of like being bullied online. It's such a problem.
Yeah.
And so I really think we need to put more resources and attention into figuring this out with our kids, you know. And there actually is a study in my book. Again, this terrified me. There was a British study in the UK that asked parents of kids from like 7 to 13 what they wanted to be when they grow up. And the vast majority chose influencer or YouTuber. Those were two separate categories. And then it was like, doctor, veterinarian after that. And then the motivations, they asked them, what are your motivations for wanting this? And they said fame and money. So now this is what we're telling people subconsciously, even or blatantly, that your value and worth is if you're like a YouTuber with lots of followers, and you know, that makes you really important, and fame and money are the most important thing. So as a culture, society, I think because of social media, we're really deviating from these values that matter most, and like real connection based on, you know, authenticity instead of all of this false narratives and like, look at me and my BMW kind of culture.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, it's so tragic. My son was the victim of some pretty horrific cyberbullying during the pandemic. So, and it was like, it was so awful. and it was terrifying because it did have this, he spiraled into a very dark place, and it was an absolutely terrifying time. And especially because it was in the pandemic, like,
yeah,
it was like, it was all bad.
I mean, hearing this stuff every time is a knife to my heart. It's just so devastating to me, mm-hmm. and the consequences of it long-term are so devastating. And I say this as a person who was bullied in junior high school without social media. One of the things that's so concerned about is that I was bullied without it. It would have been so much worse if social media was there. So I am such an advocate of anti-bullying culture and you know, trying to limit and restrict social media, which is hard for parents because they don't want their kids to be left out. There's so much to navigate, but mm-hmm. I'm super, super concerned about especially the cyberbullying and developing brains and the body dysmorphia. And it's a huge problem.
It really is. A guy that I had on the podcast a couple of weeks ago, his name is Adam Dodge, and he runs an organization called NTAB, and it is all about cyber stalking and, like, you know, putting, you know, how tech is being used as an abuse tool, essentially, and, like, how to avoid that. And we were talking about bullying, and he said, you know, when we were in high school or junior high, like, we could be bullied at school, but then we went home, right? And we closed the door, and we were safe.
Yeah.
And the bullying may have been horrible, and it may have been difficult, but it was at least it was contained to these, like, you know, six to 8 hours a day.
Right.
But with the internet, it's 24/7. There's no stopping.
They could prank call you on your landline, right? Or, you know, things like that.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
It's really not the incessant and the pile-ons that can happen online. Not just, mm-hmm. you know, with kids, or pile-ons happen and mobs come out for you on social media. And it's really bad for people's mental health. And because you can't see people or interact with them through the screen in an authentic way, it dehumanizes them again, which lowers our empathy, which again, that's kind of making us more narcissistic in a way, you know? So you can connect all of this to narcissism by, like, hey, this tech is lowering our empathy to the point where we're not seeing other people on the screen as real, the other side of the screen as real human beings.
Right. And that's such a huge thing, right? Is that I think that so much of social media has distills things into black and white. Right? People are bad or they're good. And cancel culture is all about this, right? Mm-hmm. They've done one bad thing and now they are bad.
Yeah,
that's it. And they're done. Right. Whereas if we were actually in dialogue and conversation with this person, not through a screen, not through, you know, whatever, just, you know, typing things, if we were actually in dialogue, it would open up mm-hmm. our channels of empathy.
Yeah.
But this is just sort of like systematically closing them down.
Yeah. And empathy, it's, you know, you need to see or hear someone. I also interviewed a woman for my book about, she wrote a book about empathy and technology. I think it was called The Future of Feeling by Caitlin Phillips. And she found a cool study that I also used in my book about auditory empathy. Mm. And that was, like, if you're hearing people, oftentimes you have more empathy even than seeing and hearing them. And she was saying, like, that's why podcasts, so I thought this would be interesting for you.
Oh yeah.
That's why podcasts are so good, because you're listening and you're reflecting, but you can't respond. So it's like, you're kind of, and that aspect also makes you more empathetic. And, you know, in my line of work, when I work with couples,
I was going to say, this is an imago. This is an imago thing right there.
So we're mirroring. You have to listen.
You have to.
And then auditory is so important for empathy. And so a lot of times with social media, we're not necessarily, we're not necessarily getting that auditory either. You know, again, it's just the screen with no voice, no face some of the time. So it's really important, I think, that we start recognizing when this is happening. And again, like you said earlier on, you checked yourself. I think we can all check ourselves, you know, like, I'm getting a little too obsessed here with validation. Like, I'm going to pull back a little. So I think that's part of our work, you know, as responsible digital citizens.
Yes. And so would say this is sort of, you know, your final chapter is using social media mindfully. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, protect yourself, your peace, and being an empathetic digital citizen. So is that sort of what we're taught, is the mindfulness, the checking ourselves, the.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And really being able to check in with our feelings and what we're feeling in our body when we're reacting to something on social media. And maybe that's a clue that we need breaks, or maybe we need to mute a lot of people if we don't want to unfriend them. But it's like, if you're going to stay on social media, like how can you curate it to a way that makes it a positive experience for you?
Yeah.
You know, with children, explaining to them, you can have conversations with them from a very young age about what it means to be a good digital citizen. In fact, in the cyberbully chapter, I have a little piece where it's like what to do if your child is the cyberbully. So I think we can empower ourselves a lot, you know, to, again, not just within ourselves, but to have constant conversations with our children about empathy and being, I mean, we're in my house, we're constantly talking about empathy. We're constantly talking about what would that be like for another person, you know? We're talking about responsible online behavior. My kids play Roblox. And so it's not like I do all this restriction, but we have open conversations about online safety. And, you know, my kids will come to me and they'll say, hey, mom, someone, you know, they learned a curse word, and they'll tell me, well, that's an opening for a conversation to be like, yeah, this is what this means. Don't ever say that at school, you know? Yeah,
right.
So I think like there's ways you can use this as great conversations and being connected and, you know, having your kids just, you know, I'll never be mad at you. You can come to me and tell me anything that happens on social media. I'll protect you. I'll help protect you. We'll go to the right people. Mm-hmm. You know, all of those things. So mm-hmm. I think there's things we can do to stay online and protect our peace. But we also should know that when it's time to go, it's time to go.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Oh, we could talk about this for days. But your book is coming out on the 31st. Yes.
Yes.
The Facebook Narcissist. It'll be available on Amazon, on your website,
everywhere.
Yeah.
Barnes and Noble, Apple Books, audiobook coming out, everything.
Okay, good. So on all the links for that will be in the show notes. Highly recommend you guys, because it's not going anywhere. Social media is not going anywhere, and this is kind of only getting worse, right? We have seen it escalate over the last many years. Yeah. And so
and as you said, Big Tech and Zuckerberg, they're not protecting us. So we got to figure out like how we're going to protect ourselves and our kids from all the negative effects we're seeing from it.
Yeah. Ugh. All right. Lena, where can people find you and your work?
I am lenagerhawley.com is my website. I'm not super active on social media. Big surprise. One of my good friends manages an author page for me that's not posted on very much on Facebook, but it's just Lena Gerhawley, author. But social, sometimes I'll order an article, you know. And then I'm on Instagram at Therapy with Lena, again, minimally. So yes, not great for an author who's trying to, you know, publicize my book, but it's, yeah.
But
that's where you can find me.
But just read the books. That's the most important part.
Yes.
And guys, come back. Lena and I are going to have another conversation coming up about her other book, about Chris Watts, which is a story, for anyone, it's just an endlessly fascinating story. And it was so fascinating enough that you decided to do full research about it and write a book about it. Yeah.
Probably the most dark and baffling and scary case that I've ever heard about in my lifetime. And it really, you know, asks the question, how well do you really know someone, which I think is terrifying, is do you ever really know who you're sleeping next to? And I think to be continued with that.
Ugh. All right. That's such a scary thought. Yeah. All right. We will be continued. Thank you so much, Lena. It's such a pleasure to talk to you about all this stuff. It's just a wealth of information and it's awesome. Thank you.
I'm so honored to be here. Thank you, Kate.
Thanks for tuning in to another episode of the Divorce Survival Guide podcast. If you like what you hear, head on over to Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen in and leave me a review. And don't forget to follow me on Instagram at The Divorce Survival Guide. I'll see you next time. And until then, remember, you, my love, deserve to be happy.
No one told us the truth about parenthood. Why? This is the podcast everyone needed before they had kids, because now that those little ones are here, whew, there is a lot to unpack. I'm Rachel Shepardota, and I am your host for the podcast No One Told Us, where we tell the truth about parenting and let you in on all the stuff you really should have known about before having kids. I am the founder of Hey Sleepy Baby, but this podcast is so much more than sleep. We'll be diving into all the topics that you really care about and need to know while you do your best job raising those adorable, tiny humans. Our goal is to just make you feel less alone and less overwhelmed. There are so many things that no one tells us before becoming a parent, and I think that we should really pull back the curtain on becoming a first-time or second-time mom or dad to share the good, the bad, and the ugly. We'll have a little education, a little fun, and a whole lot of heart that goes into each and every episode. So join me and our amazing guests each week to hear us talk about what no one told us